Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 24th, 2014. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Oregon Wild and Cascadia Wildlands have sued the Bureau of Land Management over the implementation of the White Castle timber sale in southwest Oregon. The Roseburg BLM office predicts that there will be no significant environmental impact from logging over 400 acres of public land. But the two environmental groups disagree and have filed an injunction to stop the sale. The White Castle sale is part of a larger plan put forth by Senator Ron Wyden that would drastically revise the way in which Oregon preserves and harvests its forests. KBOO's Keegan Heron spoke with Steve Pettery from Oregon Wild for more.
Grounds is Oregon Wild attempting to halt the White Castle timber sale?
Well, the primary problem with the White Castle sale is that the Bureau of Land Management is arguing that there's no significant environmental impact from essentially clear-cutting 438 acres. So they've done a very light environmental analysis. They haven't fully considered the impacts to endangered species, to mud and sediment running off into local rivers. And what we're trying to do is stop this sale in the long term, but in the short term, at least make sure the BLM is doing their jobs and actually analyzing the environmental impacts of clear cutting like this.
So if the White Castle timber sale is successfully stopped, what will that mean for the ONC timber plan?
Well, what we hope it means is that the Wyden plan will go back to the drawing board. What we would like to see is a plan for the ONC lands that maintains the Northwest Forest Plan. We don't think now is the time, you know, in the age of climate change, to go back to 1970-style logging. What we would like to see is a focus on restoration-based management of these lands, and that does mean there could be room for some thinning on these forests, and that we're managing these forests exclusively for logging. Or, you know, using them to generate money for things like bailing out local county budgets. That's a big part of the Wyden plan, is a desire to give money to county politicians who haven't been able to balance their budgets. And we really don't think America's public land should be used that way.
So how much forest is affected by the ONC plan that Senator Wyden has put forth?
Well, Senator Wyden's plan would affect roughly 2.2 million acres. And under his proposal, he would put about 1 million acres of public land in western Oregon under dedicated logging management. And it's a very significant change from what's happening now. We currently have the Northwest Forest Plan that was put in place by President Clinton. You know, the premise there is forests are to be managed for clean water and wildlife, with logging as a byproduct. What Wyden is proposing to do is make logging the dominant use on about 1 million acres of that public land.
I mean, this project is promoted as sustainable logging. Isn't it better than clear cutting?
It's an interesting question. You know, it's a little like the Bush administration's Clear Skies initiative. What they're doing in this sale is a virtual clear cut. They're logging about 70% of the trees in the stand and leaving a few patches around the edges and in islands in the middle. Now, that's true. That's better than an old school industrial clear cut, but it has a lot of the same problems. If you're a forest dependent animal, you're not in very good shape after that's happened. And, you know, in particular, this is not a forest where that kind of logging is either scientifically or socially acceptable. This is a stand that averages about 100 years old. There's trees over 150 years old in it. I think most folks, were they to go for a hike in this area, would think it's old growth and want it protected, not clear cut.
ONC is currently under federal jurisdiction.
Correct.
But what would happen if control of these lands was handed over to the state?
Well, that is, there is a proposal in the House of Representatives to do that. And what that proposal would do is basically manage them just like state and private lands in Oregon. And if, you know, your listeners take a drive to the Oregon coast on Highway 26 or Highway 6 and see the clear cuts out the window, that's what state management looks like. We have a unique situation in Oregon where we have the timber industry funding something called the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. They run the television ads that you see all the time saying we have the best forest laws in the country. The reality is we actually have one of the weakest states nation, and it's why we still clear cut so much. It's ecoforestry or a variable retention regeneration harvest or, you know, other euphemisms to sort of cloak the reality. This is really about the BLM trying to take its first steps back into really aggressive logging to generate money to fund county budgets.
Is there any chance of that happening, having it transferred to the state legislature?
You know, in this Congress, anything is possible. I would say normally that would be a non-starter. You know, I think at the national level, most conservation groups from Sierra Club to Natural Resources Defense Council on down, you know, view that as really dismantling Teddy Roosevelt's legacy. You know, the entire reason Roosevelt created the National System of Public Lands was to get these lands out of a situation where state and local politicians, you know, were using them as a piggy bank they could raid whenever they had a budget shortfall.
And finally, when will any type of decision be made regarding the White Castle timber sale?
You know, my guess is we should have, you know, an understanding of whether the case is going to, you know, force the BLM to do the scientific analysis by midsummer. You know, we really don't have a schedule yet from the judge or the court. But that's what we're hoping for. I don't think the BLM really wants to drag this out, and, you know, certainly neither do we. We want to resolve this question, you know, as quickly as possible. You know, an interesting wrinkle in all this is that some of the oldest trees in the White Castle stand have been occupied by tree sitters for the last several months, and the BLM is currently trying to figure out how to get those members of the public off of the public land so that they can log them.
I've been speaking with Steve Pettery of Oregon Wild. This is Keegan Herron with KBOO News.
Unusually dry and windy weather here in Oregon over the past weeks have led to prime conditions for wildfires. Although fire season typically doesn't pick up until June or July here in Oregon, there are currently 13 wildfires burning. All of them are west of the Cascades. The Oregon Department of Forestry has deployed firefighters on the ground as well as aircraft to combat the flames. Two small fires are burning near Manzanita in the Coast Range. Three more have been reported near Coos Bay. About 300 acres have been scorched in the Coos Bay blazes. An additional 200 acres is up in flames in the Santiam State Forest east of Salem. Finally, 125 acres have caught fire near the town of Shady Grove in southwest Oregon. Also, in southwest Oregon, the U.S. Geological Survey recorded an earthquake, magnitude 3.8. At 6 o'clock this morning. The epicenter was located in the Rogue Valley, roughly 26 miles northeast of Gold Beach, but no damage was reported.
Yesterday, the National Transportation Safety Board, or the NTSB, says that the cost of oil spill cleanups after rail accidents are the local taxpayers' problem. This is important to Oregon because in 2013, over 100 oil trains carrying North Dakota crude oil passed through Portland and rural towns en route to a terminal in Port Westward near Clatskanie. That rail line bisects a main street in Rainier, passes schools in Scappoose, and travels less than 100 feet from homes in St. Helens. Earlier this week, KBOO reported that oil spills from rail accidents across the U.S. last year exceeded the total volume of all railroad-related oil spills. Excuse me. The oil industry is finding that transporting oil by rail is much easier and less regulated than by tanker, barge, or pipeline, so this form of oil transportation is booming. Because of a loophole, railroads aren't required to have detailed oil spill response plans to deal with worst-case disasters, according to the NTSB. Another oil train terminal proposed for Vancouver, Washington, would be supplied by a rail line that goes through numerous residential neighborhoods and would pose similar risks. The NTSB's study of this problem was prompted by the rail car oil spill disaster in Quebec last year that killed 47 people.
KBOO reporters Chris Andre and Kristen Yount went to the City Club Friday Forum at the Governor Hotel in downtown Portland today to hear Terry Fisher, WilmerHale Professor of Intellectual Property Law at Harvard Law School. Fisher explained that a one-way regulation could ensure that pharmaceutical companies are carrying their moral weight by holding them accountable for how many lives they save.
Have a socially optimal set of drugs to address contagious diseases is not a manifestation of evil on the part of pharmaceutical firms. It's a matter of economic incentives. Okay, so what do we do here? Well, here the answer is not, as it was in the recording industry, to displace the intellectual property regime, which is failing with something else. The intellectual property regime vis-a-vis pharmaceutical products is not failing. Rather, the answer is to supplement it with other kinds of stimuli that would shift the direction of research in more socially beneficial ways. So, for example, more government subsidies for underfunded kinds of research, prizes for the development of socially beneficial but relatively non-lucrative products. There's one more possibility, more radical and therefore less likely to occur, although conceptually intriguing. We could use the government to impose on pharmaceutical firms regulations analogous to those that apply to car manufacturers, who are obliged, in their entire fleet of cars, to adhere to an aggregate so-called CAFE standard, an aggregate fuel efficiency standard. They can figure out how to do it, but they have to adhere, and slowly over time, the government has tightened the wheel, compelling increases in mileage. We haven't done that in the pharmaceutical industry, but we could. How? By requiring the firms to achieve each year an aggregate ratio, the numerator of which is their gross revenues, and the denominator of which is the number of lives they save, measured using a metric employed by the World Health Organization called DALYs, that's disability-adjusted life years, which already gives us the information we need to assess the impact of drugs throughout the world. All right, as I say, that's conceptually interesting, but less likely to happen in the near future. Instead, we could and should employ targeted subsidies to supplement the patent regime to redirect research in more socially beneficial directions.
After the forum, Chris Andre spoke with Professor Fisher about innovations in intellectual property policy that could influence stronger moral standards in industries such as drug manufacturing and fair compensation for cultural innovators. She specifically asked him about creative types who go underrepresented and undercompensated for their work, when in fact those people tend to be the most innovative and creative among us.
Well, there are two separate layers here. So one is, for the reasons I suggested in the initial presentation, intellectual property rights in general are intended to provide a reward for innovation. So innovators in an open space, meaning not already clogged with other intellectual property rights, are able, by charging more for their works than they would be in a competitive environment, to make more money. And so it's a magnet or a carrot for innovation. Now, it doesn't always work, and the music industry is an example of a circumstance in which that carrot is working less and less well, but that's the general argument. Okay, that's level one. Now, level...
Do they genuinely love it? I mean, this may sound like a very old-fashioned idea, but some people actually do what they do because they really love doing it, and that is what inspires me. They're really not very good with money or managing financial things. If they got a ton of money, they would need to hire somebody to figure out how to invest in a new laboratory or something of that sort. But money in general is not a sufficient carrot, nor is fear of lack of money a sufficient stick. I don't see how we offer people of that sort, who generally tend to be the most creative people, how do they fit into this? Do they fit?
In some cases, they do fit, and in some cases, they don't fit in the sense that the law doesn't acknowledge the variations you describe. So a circumstance in which the law does acknowledge this is one I mentioned today, fashion. People innovate in fashion not with the expectation of being able to charge monopoly prices. They innovate in fashion because they want to capture the initial wave of the market. But they know that the knockoffs are coming quite quickly.
Well, the people, though, that are more or less immune to the characteristic, these are the people who I would expect would need protection more than anyone else. They would always need this sort of protection.
Right, so I have a suggestion. I teach an online course on copyright.
Yes.
And there are two of those lectures that explore the themes you're addressing now in much more detail.
Can we link to them on our website? Would you like that?
Yeah, it's fine.
Do you have a card or information?
I have his website.
My website is on my card, and you can just go to it.
Excellent.
So the name of the course is Copyright X, and in particular, lecture number two and lecture number four are the ones that juxtapose the issues you just are talking about.
The irony of the whole thing is the feeling.
That was Terry Fisher responding to a question posed by Capitual Property Rights at today's Portland City Club.
Multnomah County Animal Services has announced the creation of a community advisory committee to get public input on how their Troutdale shelter runs. They encourage people from all walks of life to apply. Accommodations can be made for transportation, translation services, and child care. The committee will meet every other month for 2 to 3 hours. More information can be found by calling 503-789-4561 or going to the website multcopets.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin directly after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. This week, Joanne Seeby will discuss how one can develop greater self-awareness and expand their view of what is possible. Local jazz artist Julie Cole at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. This weekend's weather looks like more quasi-summer, with sunny skies on Saturday and Sunday both. Highs in the mid-50s with a low of about 33 degrees at night, so watch for ice in the mornings. Sunset will happen at about 5 minutes after 5, and sunrise will happen at about 7:40. On this date, in 1848, James Marshall found gold at Sutter's Mill near Sacramento, leading to the California Gold Rush. And on this date in 1984, the first Apple Macintosh computer was sold. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts permitted in North Portland, Damascus, Oregon has a count of 31 CPM with a high of 56, Powell Butte measures 27 CPM, in Raleigh Hills, the radiation count is 29 CPM with a high of 53, Seaside, Oregon has 32 CPM with a high of 54, and Hanford, Washington has 28 CPM with a high of 50. Way up in Canada, Vancouver, British Columbia has a radiation count of 37 counts per minute, spiking up to as high as 65. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:21, time for Jim... Let me say that again. It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We've learned from hard experience that the moral values of corporate chieftains rarely penetrate deeper than the value of their multimillion-dollar pay packages. But shouldn't we expect more from the chieftains of colleges and universities? After all, campuses are places of erudition and enlightenment, where we hope students will absorb a bit of our society's deeper ethical principles, including our historic commitment to fairness and egalitarian justice. Yet, community college officials in my town of Austin, Texas, recently issued an edict that could have come straight out of Walmart. The headline on a newspaper story about the college's edict reads, "Adjuncts at ACC face cut in hours. School seeks to avoid paying for health care." Of nearly 2,000 faculty members at the sprawling Austin Community College, three-fourths are, quote, adjunct professors, who get low pay and no health care benefits. But the new Obamacare law would have finally given them a break by requiring colleges to provide health coverage to employees who work 30 hours or more a week. But the honchos of ACC, a school with the word community in its name, have snatched this basic element of human decency out of the adjunct faculty's hands by arbitrarily decreeing that none can work more than 28 hours a week. That's a double whammy. Not only are the college chiefs denying needed health care for the people who carry ACC's teaching load, but the sneaky cut in hours means that these poorly paid professors will also suffer a pay cut. It's the Walmartization of higher education, and it's happening at all levels all across the country. This is Jim Hightower saying, did I mention that ACC provides full health coverage for the college's president and other well-paid? Isn't that a fine ethical lesson for the students to absorb?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A Nebraska judge has ruled to allow a lawsuit by undocumented youth known as Dreamers to move forward. The term Dreamers refers to the DREAM Act, which has been proposed in Congress several times without success. The act would allow undocumented youth who were brought to the country as children to have a path to citizenship. Although the DREAM Act hasn't passed in Congress, President Obama did issue an order last year allowing the affected youth to obtain legal residency, although they still have no path to obtain full citizenship. The lawsuit calls on Nebraska to restore driver's licenses to the youth after Nebraska's governor revoked their licenses in what was described as a political move to show opposition to President Obama's policies. Judge Jeffrey Chevrant rejected the government's motion to dismiss and let the lawsuit proceed, stating that a license cannot be denied based on an unlawful classification. The lawsuit was filed by the American Civil Liberties Union of Nebraska on behalf of four young immigrants following a press release issued in August of 2012 by the governor declaring that the Dreamers would be denied state driver's licenses. The plaintiffs all have permits to work and to reside lawfully here in the United States.
Heads of state, financial ministers, celebrities, and representatives from many of the world's most powerful corporations are meeting in Davos, Switzerland this week for the 2014 World Economic Forum. In advance of this year's forum, Oxfam International released a report that noted that the world's 85 richest individuals have as much wealth as 3.5 billion people, or half the world's population. One out of every five people worldwide lives in extreme poverty, and that number has increased by 70 million since the financial crisis 5 years ago. KBOO's Jinka Soderbergh spoke with Eric LeCompte, executive director of the Jubilee USA Network, a religious anti-poverty organization calling for debt amnesty for developing nations.
I wonder if you could first start by talking about the World Economic Forum that's meeting in Davos, Switzerland this weekend. What is it?
Well, the World Economic Forum, the 2014 World Economic Forum, is convening in Davos, Switzerland. The forum itself goes back to 1971. And essentially, over the last decade, the forum has become a premier gathering of elite from some of the most powerful corporations and businesses around the world, leaders, financial ministers, treasury secretaries, as well as intellectuals and others, in general about 2,000 people that gather to talk about improving the state of the world. And what's really interesting is while this group of people is debating improving the world, we also, at the summit in Davos, Switzerland, see a host of corporate players that have been tax avoiders, as well as political leaders who've been connected to corruption.
So your group calls for debt amnesty in a lot of cases, dropping the debt of some nations that are suffering and having to starve their own people in certain instances, like the former president of Tanzania said, in order to pay the debts they owe internationally. What would be the result, do you think, if some of these debts worldwide were dropped?
You know, around the world right now, the level of indebtedness is keeping many countries and many groups of people trapped in poverty, and certainly many people actually trapped in extreme poverty. So, you know, I think it's really important when we look at an example like the Philippines. You know, since Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines has continued to pay $22 million a day on its debt payment. About $500 million has come into the country to help with Typhoon Haiyan and rebuilding and relief efforts. But since the typhoon struck, the Philippines has paid $1.5 billion in external debt payments. And much of this debt goes back to the corrupt dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos. So this is a very clear example where if the debt was canceled in the Philippines, essentially, you know, they would be able to have the money to rebuild in the Philippines, as well as to deal with the impacts of climate change. And so we see inequality is a great concern, and the debt crisis is also one of the causes of the global financial crisis that we just experienced.
Well, obviously, there is a great deal of difficulty in influencing the people at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, this week. Are there things that people can do locally that could make an impact on policy regarding global debt and inequality?
Yes. I mean, there are some things that are really important. I would invite your listeners to go to our website, jubileeusa.org, right now. On the example I brought up of the Philippines, when you visit jubileeusa.org, you could take action that sends a letter to the World Bank, as well as other international financial institutions, you know, to let them know that we need to have a moratorium on the debt that's keeping people in poverty in the Philippines. But we'd also urge listeners to call their member of Congress and ask them to support legislation like the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Amendment, or to support efforts around the Jubilee Act for responsible lending and borrowing.
I've been speaking with the director of Jubilee USA, Eric LeCompte. Their website again, jubileeusa.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Consumer Reports has published a study of soft drinks that contain or is known as 4-MEI, which has been shown to cause cancer in mice but has not been tested on human cells. 4-MEI is a coloring agent, and it doesn't affect the flavor. Pepsi products had among the highest amounts of 4-MEI. Sprite, Dr. Pepper, and Coca-Cola had trace amounts. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the data and conducting its own tests to determine whether or not the chemical is harmful. Pepsi's also been replacing its brands that were formerly labeled as natural with the buzzword Simply. For example, Natural Quaker Oats is now in stores known as Simply Quaker Oats. This shift in marketing is the result of a number of lawsuits filed in the past few years challenging the ubiquitous labeling of the word natural on snack food items. According to the FDA, foods labeled as natural should not contain added color or artificial flavors or synthetic substances. Naked Juice, which is owned by Pepsi, was forced to drop its title of all natural last year when it was proven that this beverage contained artificial ingredients. Other companies, such as Breyers Ice Cream, Ben & Jerry's, and General Mills, have all altered their marketing words in the last year to comply with these guidelines.
Yesterday, the Central African Republic swore in its first female president, even as violence erupted in the capital of Bangui. Catherine Samba Panza was elected by the National Transitional Council as an interim president while the country tries to regain its footing after intense fighting in the past months between Christian and Muslim groups. Almost 1 million people have been displaced since a coup in March, but a Muslim rebel group in power in place of the elected government. Samba Panza was the mayor of the capital, Bangui, before her appointment as president and has called for all Muslim and Christian fighters to lay down their weapons. Despite the presence of African and French peacekeeping troops in the region, this plea seems unlikely to gain ground anytime soon. Earlier today, the former government health minister, Joseph Kalite, was killed by Christian groups. Thousands of citizens have fled the upsurge of Christian violence, which has been aimed at Muslims across the board. The original coup consisted largely of militant Muslims from neighboring countries who saw an opportunity to take control of a floundering government. Violence has also spread to nearby northern Nigeria, where the Muslim rebel group Boko Haram has killed dozens and torched villages in the past week. This has caused even more refugees to Chad.
In Geneva today, United Nations-sponsored peace talks concerning Syria are continuing. But opposition leaders said they don't want to be in the same room with representatives of the government. Although the opposition is fragmented, at least one faction said they would not participate in the talks until President Assad agrees to establish an interim ruling body during the resolution phase of the now three-year-old conflict. However, mediator Lakhdar Brahimi convinced the two sides to sit down for a mediation session that will take place tomorrow.
A group of five Afghan sportsmen were shot and killed on Thursday in the Laman province of Afghanistan. Authorities stated that a gunman riding a motorcycle opened fire on the group during a sports match and then fled the scene. A provincial spokesman speculated that the Taliban may be behind the incident. When the Taliban were in charge in Afghanistan, they imposed severe restrictions on sports and public celebrations. However, a local Taliban spokesman completely rejected this allegation, stating that whoever killed the athletes was not connected with them. No group has claimed responsibility for the killing.
Over the past few months, the Affordable Care Act has gotten a lot of attention from the mainstream press. Yet, out of all that media attention, little of it is focused on how the new health care law will affect prisoners in the thousands of jails all across the country. With the expansion of Medicaid, millions of former inmates will now get access to benefits. KABU reporter Ryan Katz has more.
Every year in the United States, around 730,000 people are released from jail. Most of them, as many as up to two-thirds, come out with problems related to drugs.